Talk given Sunday, 20th of March, 1977. The outstanding difference between the manner in which the worldling and the striver after the religious life functions, as far as his consciousness is concerned, from the manner in which the consciousness of the fulfilled religion is concerned, is a point which we should meditate upon very deeply and constantly. The worldling attends, is conscious with reactions from him to that to which he is attending. The religia who has come to fruition, or to use a common phrase, come to the end of the path and has realized his fruition as the full human being, attends without any personal reactions whatsoever. Consider this matter very carefully, because it is of the utmost importance. The worldling reacts to what he attends in accordance with his conditioned mind. And all those reactions express the degree and the manner in which we are subject to our imperfections. And in contrast to this, the religia, the fulfilled religia, who has no reactions, is one, therefore, whose mind has come to the unconditioned state, which is the state of utter freedom, the perfect freedom of mind. He is utterly devoid of all ill, therefore. Because when the psyche has realized this unconditioned state, it is one with universal mind. If you use theistic terms, it is the divine mind which functions through him. Or if you like the Trismegistic form, all-father mind functions through him quite freely. So there are no personal reactions whatsoever. This does not mean that there is no response from the fulfilled religion. The response in his case is one which emerges out of transcendence itself as it functions freely through his psychophysical organism. Therefore, he does not add to the world's ill. He's an influence for the purification, a psychical influence for the purification of the world's ill, silently, invisibly. He neither concurs with the world, nor does he object to anything in the world. These are very important points to bear in mind. And we'll try and see why this is so. The worldling, on the other hand, is constantly reacting in according to his mental conditioning, which of course also implies his moral conditioning. The worldling contributes, therefore, to the world's psychical state of confusion, of anxiety and fear, of greed, violence, delusion, and so forth. Because all these qualities are manifest wheresoever the psyche, conditioned through ignorance, through impurity, through the absence of poise, is reacting to whatsoever happens in the world and whatsoever comes to him from the world. It is not easy to look into this, partly because it is so enormous, the extent of it is overpowering. But nevertheless, that is a fact. And because the world condition is a very ill condition, this power of illness let loose in the world, and it has been let loose for ages and ages, sweeps up any individual in its overpowering current. Have you not often wondered why you got so upset at this, that, or the other? You would say, now when I was in the country last week in the midst of all that beauty and loveliness, nothing of this struck me. But when I came home that evening, turned on the news and heard this, that, and the other, I immediately plunged into anger and hate and fear and all the rest of it. You see, one gets swept up by this world condition. There is no sense in condemning oneself for it. That must be borne in mind. This is what happens. And one must be as awake and alert as possible to what is actually happening in one's own psyche all the time, the psychical reactions. Now, it is these very psychical reactions which are the pointers to us of our particular task. How do we realize or shall I put it in the truer way? How is the state of purity, of poise, of compassion, of understanding, to establish itself in us, emerge out of us, and affect our world? Because if we can do that, then it means that the fulfilled religia is responding rightly to everything that happens in the world. It is a question of the transformation of one's whole mode of awareness of existence. I've said this before, time and again. This is the story, the whole story of our spiritual development, of our coming to fulfillment as individual human beings. And do bear in mind, the fulfillment is not our personal fulfillment. It is not our property, not our attainment, not our achievement. The fulfillment is the fulfillment of totality. We always forget that, simply because, if not in our conscious selves, in the unconscious part of that, which is the 9/10 of the iceberg below the surface of the water, we are completely ego-driven, concerned with self. So we want to draw everything to ourselves. If one can be quiet enough in one's mind and become aware of these inner processes, it is quite possible and not so difficult with practice to become well aware of all the inner processes. One sees that one is totally under the domination of the I. The limited I. I want, I wish, I like, I this, and I that, and I the other, and so forth. All the time it is there. And it manifests itself in a thousand different ways during our daily life. But we are unaware of these manifestations, generally speaking, excepting for the obvious manifestations, which one cannot fail to notice. But most of these manifestations are what we call our natural behavior. But that natural behavior indicates just exactly what we are. The way we talk, the way we move, and so on. Everything that we do, all the physical things to start with. You know how the Buddha emphasized the importance of mindfulness with respect to the body. Whether one is standing, sitting, walking, eating, drinking, etc., etc. Complete mindfulness. What am I doing? How am I doing it? Because this shows up what is in the depths of the psyche. And as one becomes mindful in this way, one gathers self-knowledge, not only with respect to external bodily behavior, but to the manner in which the psyche is functioning all the time. And if one really begins to awaken to this, one will see how the I-consciousness, the isolating I-consciousness, separating us from the not-self, so-called, is predominantly active in our being all the time. Now, because this I-consciousness, this separative I-consciousness is active this way, it reacts back upon the external world against anything which is unpleasant and in favor of what is pleasant. So we can't be free of resentment and violence on the one hand, and greed and possessiveness, and the associated fears and anxieties with both factors on the other hand. One cannot emphasize sufficiently the importance of this mindfulness. Watch the inner reactions all the time. And those inner reactions and the outward behavior will release, the observation of those will release true self-knowledge. In the process of this release of self-knowledge, we will naturally experience considerable depression, considerable sorrow, a sense of helplessness, a sense of failure, and so on. The pleasant things will elate us. The unpleasant things will depress us. And after each one of them, there comes the period, there comes the situation where the balloon is pricked and one is just flat. So, we have to summon our energy from within. We have to keep going without flagging, which is an extremely difficult task. Keep going without flagging. Why? Because people like ourselves are, to some degree or other, truly concerned with living the religious life, with living in such a manner that the purpose of our human existence is fulfilled. And one way in which we can express in thought and word the purpose of our human existence is just this, that each one of us has to become the living vehicle of transcendence itself. All the great religions have presented this in some form or other. You have it straight away in the first chapter of Genesis. And Elohim said, "Let us make man in our own living image." We are the living image of Elohim, God. You find it in the Hermetic teachings. then all father mind. A very interesting way of presenting God. All father mind made man in his own image, with whom he fell in love because he was beautiful beyond compare. It's very interesting that this trismegistic presentation, which is here in its Hellenistic form, should emphasize beauty, which we always associate with Greece. The Hellenistic mind emphasized beauty more, perhaps, than elsewhere. You find it in almost every page of the Upanishads that man is Brahman embodied. If you go further back than the Upanishads into the Atharva Veda, you will find two very remarkable hymns in which the question is asked, who made man? And the answer is given in terms like this: such and such a divinity, such and such a god. The word deva, which is used there, should be understood by us as an archetypal energy. That is the simplest and the about the most accurate way of understanding. Such and such an archetypal energy made his bones. Such and such made his blood. Such and such made this. Such and such made the other. They use the word deva. And after that, all the devas entered into man and resided inside him. Then it goes on to present the great trinity, Brahma, Prajapati, Indra. They all entered into man. So he who knows man, understands man, regards him as Brahman's self. Rather a awesome responsibility. Tremendous. Divinity embodied. The one supreme, absolute, all-containing, all-encompassing divinity made man and resides within him. Now you may ask, then how is it that sin and evil and so on comes out of man? If you read those hymns in the Atharva Veda, you will find that all these are also mentioned as divinities. Then sin and death and all the terrible things, they also entered man. And all this comprises Brahman's self, the self of the Absolute, of the Supreme Being, the Supreme God, the ultimate power of, use any term you like. This is extremely instructive. And it needs all our courage and strength to bear the impact of the full realization of this great teaching. Now, relate this to our reactions. We, as we are, in our state of ignorance, not really knowing that we are transcendence embodied, we'll accept the words because it sounds very grand and pleasant, satisfies our ego, balloons it up wonderfully. I am God. You see, which is utterly nonsensical, of course. We, in our state of ignorance, do not know this fact, that everything is there within us. We have moralistic interpretations of what we call the good aspects, all the so-called virtuous aspects, and the bad aspects, as we call them. We wish to possess the good because we are at that immature stage where we take sides with what is pleasant against that which is unpleasant. And in our ordinary material life, and with our ordinary upbringing as children by our parents and educators and so forth, and by virtue of the socio-cultural heritage which we have, we are conditioned in such a way that we say, oh, I like this, this is pleasant, I'll have more of it, I'll cultivate it, I'll develop it, I will possess it, I will accumulate it. This I don't like, it's unpleasant, it's hurtful, out with it. I'll destroy it if necessary, if I can. You see, this is what we do in our limited context. We are conscious only in terms of a separate self, not in terms of the totality. You see, again, where consciousness comes in, and the nature in which we, the manner in which we are conscious of ourselves and of the totality of existence. So, we don't realize that these things which we call evil, which we call unpleasant, are, in terms of totality, complementary energies to those energies which function in the manner which is acceptable and pleasant to us. It's very important to understand these things step by step. Why now? Let me put it this way. What is there in our constitution which makes us slide into this unintelligent desire to possess the pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant? It is the pleasure-pain mechanism of our own bodies, to start with, the physical pleasure-pain mechanism. Nature has ingrained that in us in order that the body may survive, because without that mechanism, the body wouldn't survive. But nature has not dealt with the psychical part of it. The psychical part is our responsibility. Otherwise, we'd never grow in intelligence, in true perception. What is our responsibility? See what happens actually with the psychical reaction. I like this. This is the psychical reaction to the physical pleasure. I want more of it. I get attached to that which produces pleasure. The body doesn't get attached to that which produces pleasure. The body doesn't resent on its own, as purely as a material body. It doesn't resent or experience aversion, develop an aversion against that which is an unpleasant sensation. They are just sensations. It's a machine which works. You see? But the psyche is the thing that produces the resentment and accumulates it. So it is the psyche which is the real battleground of opposing forces, made a battleground by our ignorance and our incapacity to perceive truly. And therefore our incapacity to accept the totality of experience and of life and the processes of the world and of life. Now, because this is the case, and also aided by the upbringing and education which we receive from parents and teachers and society and friends and so on, all of whom are equally ignorant and equally incapable and unknowing, we grow in pleasure lust. Now this is a point of fundamental importance, absolutely fundamental importance, where the living of the religious life is concerned. The sense of pleasure is the first thing with which we start our existence. If that pleasure is thwarted, there is immediate resentment. All of you who are parents know exactly what the little brat does the moment there is any displeasure caused the little one by depriving it of its pleasurable experience. Resentment is the immediate reaction. Pleasure comes first. Attachment comes first. Then comes the reaction of anger and all the rest of it, if that attachment is interfered with. So we grow up as the slaves of pleasure lust, and associated with that pleasure, which expresses itself in the beginning in food and drink, and from adolescence with sex and all that sort of thing, and with our life in the world, of in society, with the sense of power, of possession, of being, big man, rich man, with status symbols and so forth. And whatnot, and the whole story. It's a miserable story, but there it is. If wealth is there, which has come to us naturally, by heritage or whatever it is, or by one's own skill and so forth, and you have built it up, but you are not attached to it possessively, if you do not make it a value in itself, and if you realize that you are a trustee for the right use of it, then it is your duty, your business, to utilize, to produce and to utilize wealth. That's quite a different situation. But otherwise, it feeds the ego, feeds our vanity, and so forth. So we are the slaves of pleasure lust. And our activity of mindfulness is something which constantly shows this up to us, in some way or other. Now, don't make the age-old mistake. Repress, suppress, forcibly deny the pleasure. No one can live sanely and healthily, physically healthily, without pleasure. Now you will say to me, good gracious me, then what do you want us to do? (Clears throat) Consider carefully. Science itself has discovered, modern science, in the last few years, the indispensability of pleasure for the health of the organism. But what sort of pleasure is this? This is where the wisdom of the great teachers comes in. It is the pleasure that comes naturally to you. If you use your sense of sight, your sense of hearing, of touch, of taste, of smell, and so on, if you use your senses rightly, fully by virtue of complete attention to what's going on, if you use your senses rightly and fully to everything that comes to you from outside, then how will you take that into yourself? In what manner will you take that into yourself? If you take it unpossessively, fully experience it as it happens, and let it pass, let the shape of the experience pass away. Life is not a static thing. If you don't let that pleasure experience become fossilized, in terms of memory and the desire for its repetition and so forth and so forth. If it comes to you unsought, if it comes to you unplanned, you experience it to the full, and in the experiencing it, let it pass right out of your being, then you are not the slave of your pleasure lust, but you are a true disciple, a true learner. True happiness, true happy experience. And consider, can you possibly avoid this tide of pleasure which all nature is constantly pouring into you and through your being, if only you remain poised and the right receptacle for the influx of this pleasure. A lovely sunrise, wonderful dawn, the freshness and the beauty of it, and the dew on the grass. Or a hailstorm, thunder and lightning. Isn't it marvelous as it all happens? Maybe frightening sometimes. The smile on the face of a child, or its extraordinary vitality, the way it just keeps jumping about as if it had 10 million kilowatts of energy all exploding from within. Most of you know all about that. Perhaps all of you know about that. Either through your own children or watching other children and so forth. Wonderful music, poetry, the activities of the intellect, the discoveries, they are marvelous, they are wonderful. How will you avoid that tide of pleasure, that overwhelming tide of pleasure coming to you? Because it's taking place all the time, every day. You can't avoid it. So you're bound to have all that. But if you are free from possessiveness with regard to it, from storing it up, from saying, oh, I like this, I want more of it. If you are free of that, then you are free of lust. And you are free of all the ill consequences of lust. This is the point to bear in mind. It's the approach to all experience, and it is the attitude to all experience, and it is a case of the manner in which you receive it into your own whole being. Now you may say, oh well, that sounds very nice. I can surely work along those lines. But you'll say, what about the horrible things that happen? The assassinations, the cruelties, the sort of invisible spirit of evil, the devil incarnate, so to say, in the world's psyche, in its evil mental functioning, its machinations, its devilry, the ill planning, the suspicion, the hatred, the nurturing of trouble and producing confusion and difficulty everywhere, one state against another, one man against another, and so on and so on. What about all that? Surely, that one should stand up against it, root it out, and so forth. First, consider something which we talked of a few moments ago. Sin and evil and all the terrible things entered man. The archetypal energies, the devas, the gods, who are the lords of sin and evil and so forth, entered man and made their abode in him. These are all energies. That is to say, they are the one total energy, the one and only energy of the universe, manifesting in this manner, that manner, that manner, that manner. They all entered man and made their abode. Now, take your own body. Supposing you're quite healthy, full of the joy of life. You see, you're quite happy. Bodily, you're perfectly happy, because there is no illness, there is no pain, etc. But have you ever considered deeply what is happening inside this body, which is full of confidence, calm, fearlessness, and all the rest of it? Is quite happy. Really happy, remember, because it's really healthy. But what is happening now? In order that the body may live, it takes in from the world. All day long, all night long, we breathe. And we breathe out. We think of it as promoting life, as a constructive process. What does the oxygen do when it gets into your system? It burns up this, that, and the other. The process of oxygenation is a process of burning. But if my house caught fire and burnt, how do I feel about it? terrible, horrible, oh, awful event took place. But there is constant burning going on in this house, which is the body. I don't complain about that. Take, this is arson, isn't it? Burning. Take murder. There are millions of bacteria inside the body. Whose business? They are your allies, your armies. Whose business is to do battle with all the viruses and, as we say, destroy them. Otherwise, the viruses will get the better of us and they will be dead. A mighty battle going on there, and the most awful carnage. All right? What about the poor viruses being murdered right inside our own being? So you see, the dual process is going on all the time. But, and here comes the important point, it is only insofar as this dual process functions in balance that there is well-being and harmony. There is cosmos. Otherwise, there is an upset. There is an imbalance and things go wrong. Just as in our psychical life, the I like, I wish, I want more is in imbalance with that which wants to get rid of evil and so forth. If the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body goes wrong, the body will be ill. Because the psychological, the psychical activities within the psyche in reaction to whatever happens are in imbalance, everything goes wrong within the psyche. And this brings up the question of values. Our conditioning imposes values. This is good and right and proper. Take it, cultivate it. This is not done. It's against the club rules. Get rid of it, etc., etc., etc. So that affects the purely intellectual side of our life too. Now, the happy body is the healthy body in which there is the balance of the forces of construction and destruction, of good and evil, if you like to use moralistic terms. If we are intelligent, then we can see this as the fact and naturally accept the fact. There is no denying the fact. It is there. We see it as such. Now, supposing we can be conscious of all mankind, each one of us, separate individuals, can be conscious of all the 4,000 millions who compose mankind. In this totally accepting manner, this understanding manner, then when we hear that, oh, in such and such a place, such terrible things took place and assassinations and so forth, would we react against them? Would we resent them, hate them? Don't say, oh, I hate the evil, but not the evil doer, not the man. That is nonsense. There is no evil in the world if there wasn't an evil doer. Could there be any evil in the world if there were no evil doers? Well, there we are, you see. So, if we see in this complete and total way, there is no hate whatsoever, no resentment whatsoever. This reaction of hate or resentment, is this aversion, is due to the separative I consciousness. But if the I consciousness embraces all humanity, it doesn't resent humanity. The individuals composing humanity. Similarly, if the I consciousness is all inclusive, is truly inclusive, it's not separative, then whosoever does good isn't sort of worshipped as, worthy of all praise and everything and so forth, and one doesn't get attached to it, to him or her. Attachment on the one hand, or aversion on the other hand, for anybody or anything binds. And it prevents this particular organism, oneself, being the unresisting, completely open, utterly pure, living vehicle through which transcendence functions. Now, if we understand this carefully, really begin to understand it in such a manner that we naturally become free of our reactions one way or the other way, then the religious life is indeed coming to fruition in us. And if we understand this, we will also understand why it is that of all things, the great teachers, the founders of the religions, and all the great spiritual teachers emphasized more than anything else the simple moral teachings. Be free from harming, from taking what is not yours, from stealing, from the indulgence of the senses. Please distinguish indulgence of the senses from right use of the senses. Right use of the senses will give you your full quota to the fill. You'll be filled to the brim and overflowing with right pleasure, which will mean health for you, well-being for you. Be free of untruthfulness, and so on and so on. But you will also notice that when the great teachers gave these simple teachings, they did not produce any philosophical or metaphysical systems or anything at all. It was quite unnecessary. See? When these great teachers gave these teachings, they presented them not only in their limited context of the ordinary life of the everyday world, but also in the transcendent context of the person who was free of all isolativeness within himself, one who could accept the totality and understand the totality. Now there's one other point. When one sees the horrible things, hears about them, has to deal with them and so on, of course one sees that this is evil, this is horrible. If one remains poised and calm within oneself, that is within our own power, if we choose to exercise it and let that power grow. If we remain poised and calm, then in the midst of all the filth and the horror, we exercise a peculiar dormant faculty within us. By taking in to the full, without rejecting any of the horror or the evil, that inward peace and quiet is a center of purity and of purification, a center of purificatory power. You transmute the evil that comes into you, and it flows out again quite naturally as a healing force in the world around. You don't have to plan how this evil shall be tackled, because our planning, our little brains can never compass all the factors at play. But this we can do. We become centers of healing by virtue of the fact that we are pure and whole. In this state of acceptance, there's an extraordinary realization, a living experiencing of the meaning of compassion. We don't know what love is or compassion is. We know something like condescending pity or all sorts of things like that. But they are all petty, the things, all the wonderful things that we experience and pour out, they are all petty compared with the reality. The reality is something absolutely stupendous. You just can't talk about it. That is why you are utterly silent. This is the true silence. One aspect of it. Then, with that compassion, there is also complete understanding. There is complete acceptance. They are almost interchangeable terms. They are not. It is not an acceptance in the sense of I accept. There is no I accepting. There is acceptance taking place. The universal, a universal phenomenon taking place through the individual. And in that state, if you have ever touched it or seen it in some way or other, you know the supreme meaning of happiness. So now, that is a terrible thing to say, that at the heart of the evil and the horror of the world, there is the realization of happiness. For you, the individual person, if there is poise, if you allow this compassion, this understanding to well forth. So the whole element of lust goes right out of happiness, of pleasure, as well as of the displeasurable, the horrible and the evil. Very important, most important, to understand this and let one's whole awareness of existence undergo that transformation which means that the separative, isolative I consciousness has vanished. There is no more selfness in the self, which has now become the living vehicle of transcendence itself.